Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In mid-November, Washington and Beijing mutually agreed to start granting journalist visas to each other's journalists again, putting an end to months of reciprocal visa rejections and denials. A perhaps minor, yet still significant, thawing amongst a grander narrative of decoupling and worsening relations between the two countries. Cheng Li's Middle Class Shanghai, Reshaping U.S.-China Engagement, published by Brookings in March 2021, plots out a new way to understand the U.S.-China relationship. Cheng Li's book attempts to show the importance of the city of Shanghai to China's economic and political development, and studies its population to show the continued value of engagement between America and China. Cheng Li is the director of the John L. Thornton China Center and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. He is also the director of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. We're joined today as well by Brian Wong. Brian, could you say a few words about yourself?
Thank you very much, Nicholas. I'm a Rhodes Scholar, DPhil and Politics Candidate at Balliol College, Oxford, and a co-founder of the Oxford Political Review. I'm also a columnist with the Hong Kong Economic Journal and contributor to the Nate Tan newsletter.
Today, the three of us are going to talk about the city of Shanghai, its importance to China, and why looking at U.S.-China relations through the prism of a single city might be a better way to understand the international system. So, Cheng, thank you so much for joining me and Brian today. Let's perhaps start with the city of Shanghai. Why focus on Shanghai as a way to understand both China's domestic politics and its relations with the United States?
Well, first of all, honor and pleased with both of you. I'm also glad that you start with the essential question, why Shanghai? There are three main reasons that I have focused on Shanghai. First, understanding Shanghai is vital to understanding modern China. A famous Chinese saying is quite revealing. It goes like this. To learn about a 2,000-year Chinese history, one should visit Xi'an. To understand the 500-year Middle Kingdom, one has to see Beijing. To grasp the past 100 years of changes in China, one must look at Shanghai. Now, secondly, Shanghai is currently the pace setter in China's new search for global power, and its role will shape how China will act and how the outside world will respond to the emergence of global China. But here, I wanted to address my argument that the middle-class Shanghai actually reveals China's unsettled future, because Shanghai embodies what I call two tails of a city. As the so-called head of dragon, Shanghai has reflected China's industrial policy and perhaps also state capitalism. But we should not forget that Shanghai has been the frontier city of market reforms, opening up, and cosmopolitanism. Shanghai was, is, and will be deeply are integrated into the international system. For example, Shanghai is now the world's busiest container port. Singapore is the second, and by the way, Hong Kong is the seventh. Now, critics of Shanghai and China may reasonably argue that Shanghai is a showcase of China's growing aggressive global outreach. But it's also true that Shanghai represents the vanguard of the middle class worldly voices, views, and values. Certainly, and most importantly, my book argues that Shanghai and China, indeed, should not be perceived in a monolithic and a stagnant way. Its internal contradictions and the paradoxical dynamics deserve much attention. The future of the Shanghai is, of course, unwritten. In fact, China's trajectory is not predetermined, and it faces serious constraints due to both domestic and international factors. And it's also embodies some interesting contrasts and different options. As Dr. Henry Kissinger recently noted, I quote, China is still in the middle of searching for the nature of its place in the world, end quote. How the Chinese dynamics unfold will make a big difference. The United States, especially grand strategy toward China, therefore, must be holistic, multifaceted, forward-looking, and flexible. Unfortunately, there's some problem at the current U.S. approach toward China. This is why I have written this book.
So thank you, Cheng. And I want to ask you a follow-up question on that, which is just how important is and has Shanghai been to China's economic development? And how has that role changed over the past decades, especially since Gai Ge Kai Fang, so the economic reforms and opening up era under Deng?
Well, since the early 1990s, Chinese authorities have designated Shanghai as the so-called head of dragon, symbolizing the leading role of Shanghai in China's quest for power and prosperity in the 21st century. Now, this metaphor also suggests that Shanghai leads the Yangtze River Delta region, and more broadly, the whole country in China's efforts to play economic catch-up with more developed countries. Now, the degree of favorable policies toward Shanghai has varied from time to time due to changes in the top leadership in Dongnanhai. But Shanghai has set the pace for the country's socio-economic development over much of the past four decades. Now, by 2019, I mean, before the COVID, this is also 40 years after China's began its economic reforms, national GDP had grown 60 times larger, this is the whole country, and the per capita income 25 times higher. In 1979, China's per capita GDP was less than $300, about only 3% of that of the United States. But GDP per capita has increased from about $1,000 in 2001 to 10,000 in 2020, and is expected to reach 30,000 by 2035. Now in Shanghai, per capita GDP already exceeded $23,000 last year in 2020. Now, so I just want to use middle class as a showcase to see the China's Shanghai's role in China's economic development. Now, the book focuses on Shanghai, but also documents the remarkable expansion of the middle class throughout the country. 10 years ago, 40% of China's relatively small urban middle class residents lived in the four cities, what we call Tier 1 city, Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou and Shenzhen. According to a study conducted by Dominic Barton, and the former head of McKinsey, and most recently, and Canadian ambassador to China, now he is the CEO of Rio Tinto, I believe that he got that offer. And also, based on his study, this is really many years ago, along with his colleague at McKinsey, the fast growth of the middle class has really spread beyond these four tier cities I just mentioned, tier one cities in recent years, to other Chinese cities, including Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities in inland region. By next year, 2022, the proportion of China's middle class that resides in those mega cities is expected to drop, you know, to about 16%, from 40% about 20 years ago to 16%, while 76% of the middle class will live in Tier 2 and the Tier 3 cities. That's telling the story. Shanghai is a pace setter for China's economic development. So that's very important. It's a pioneer, but it's not just about Shanghai. It's to go beyond Shanghai, go beyond the Yangtze River Delta, and to be the case for the entire country.
So you note in your book that China's been a source, sorry, not China, Shanghai's been a source for a lot of China's political leadership. And so I kind of wanted to kind of get into, you know, is there something about being based in Shanghai that affects the views and mindsets, the politicians that come from there? I especially want to focus on Jiang Zemin, whose, I think, reputation has been seen in a much more positive light recently. How did being based in Shanghai affect Jiang Zemin's approach to governing?
This is a very good question. Actually, the book has one chapter focusing on Shanghai leaders. Now, first, let me make it clear that the Shanghai leaders have never been identical. In PRC history, there have been some leftist or Maoist radicals, such as Gang Fu, who were all from Shanghai. There, of course, have been more moderate and well-known reform leaders, such as Zhu Rongji and Mayor Xu Huangdi, and of course, Jiang Zemin as well. Now, having said that, I do believe that leaders of Shanghai origin or those who have spent much of their careers in Shanghai have some distinct features from having run this most cosmopolitan city in the country. It is interesting to point out that after the Tiananmen incident, Deng Xiaoping surprised everyone by designating a Shanghai leader, Jiang Zemin, to be his successor. In 1990, 1 year after, Deng Xiaoping said, I quote, "One of my big mistakes was I did not include Shanghai when I launched 4 special economic zones in 1980s, end quote. Now, that same year, Shanghai launched its historical plan for developing Pudong. Now, let me directly answer your question about Jiang Zemin. As we know, Jiang Zemin was born here in Shanghai. He studied and worked in Shanghai for many decades, and he liked to be identified as a Shanghainese. Now, this experience certainly profoundly influenced his cosmopolitan traits, you may argue. Now, he unambiguously embraced Western culture, and he has been known for his endorsement of cultural pluralism and transnationalism. You know, my book, I spent a lot of time talking about architecture in Shanghai, and especially since the 1990s, and his leadership. But actually, he started that in the middle 1980s when he was a Shanghai leader, and he further encouraged. As we know that Jiang Zemin allowed an Italian opera, team to perform in the Forbidden City. That was actually a big no-no at that time for many conservatives. He invited a French architect to design a postmodern grand theater, for Tiananmen Square, and also urged the Chinese public to watch the American film Titanic. He said he watched twice. He was deeply moved. This is in his formal remarks in the party meetings. In 1999, China published some 5,000 foreign book titles, accounting for 10% of the total number of newly published books. This is truly remarkable, a relatively high percentage compared to the share of the foreign books published in other countries. I think probably only China published so many of these kind of foreign books. Now, President Jiang has been recognized by many analysts, both in China and abroad, for implementing a moderate approach to crises such as Taiwan's presidential election in 1996, and the Belgrade embassy bombing in 1999, and EP3 airplane crash in Hainan Island in 2001. Similarly, Zhu Rongji also strongly and skillfully push for negotiation leading to China's accession to the WTO 20 years ago. Now, these soft actions or reactions by Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji and other Shanghai leaders were criticized by many Chinese at the time, but they are now widely regarded by the public as wise policies.
So on that question, actually, I want to ask an interesting follow-up, which is essentially President Xi has been described by some commentators as a social conservative and an economic egalitarian. He also served as Secretary of Zhejiang and briefly of Shanghai, although he's been noted for having strong connections to various sort of mid to senior tier officials that rose up the ranks, both during and also after his tenure in Shanghai. Cheng, what do you make of Xi's relationship with Shanghai in relation to your thesis just then, and how this has, if at all, shaped his current ideological positions on China's overarching direction?
Well, this is a very, very important question. I think I'm so glad you raised that question. Actually, my book, this chapter, directly answers that question with the title of the chapter is From Jiang to Xi, the Enduring Power and the Influence of the So-Called Shanghai Game. Now, Xi Jinping has a complicated relationship with the so-called Shanghai Game. Xi Jinping was largely promoted to or endorsed by Jiang Zemin and the former vice president, Zheng Qinhong, who were co-founders of the Shanghai Game. So you can say without Jiang Zemin and without Zheng Qinhong, there's no Xi Jinping as a top leader. You can even go that far to argue that. Now, Xi Jinping also spent 8 months as party chief of Shanghai before moving to Beijing to become the designated successor to Hu Jintao in 2007. Now, most important, interestingly, Xi Jinping is now surrounded by his confidants who also advanced their career in Shanghai, including Power Bureau Standing Committee member Wang Funing and Executive Vice Premier Han Zheng. These are two in the Power Bureau Standing Committee, seven members of the Power Bureau Standing Committee. I think you can assume that they have a very good relationship. Although Wang Funing's rise and Han Zheng's rise is more attributed to Jiang Zemin than to Xi Jinping. Now, anti-corruption chief Yang Xiaodu and foreign policy chief Yang Jiezi and Xi Jinping's chief of staff Ding Xueqiang, they all, met Xi Jinping and developed a good relationship, I mean, through Shanghai and also through some other, experiences. So really, Xi Jinping very boldly promote and use Shanghai leaders, particularly Ding Xueqiang. I think he first met with him when Xi Jinping served 8 months as Shanghai Party chief. Ding Xueqiang was his chief of staff at that time in Shanghai Municipal Party Committee. Now he's the chief of staff in the Central Committee in Beijing. And the Ding will likely emerge as one of the most powerful leaders in the country in the next 5 years and beyond. Now, I will not be surprised that more than half of the Power Bureau Standing Committee members in the 20th Party Congress next October or November, more than half will likely have served as the top leaders in Shanghai. They include Xi Jinping, possible Han Zheng, and he is one of the few leading candidates for next premier, Ding Xueqiang, the person I just mentioned, and Li Qiang, current Shanghai Party boss, and Li Xi, currently party boss in Guangdong, but served as a senior leader in Shanghai, including head of organization department and also deputy secretary of Shanghai for 4 years. And also new party bureau member with Shanghai leadership experience, including the candidate, including Ying Yong, the person served as Shanghai mayor, then later moved to Hubei during the COVID-19 crisis, really did a fantastic job, you know, after he arrived there to crack down, Wuhan COVID-19. That was a really very critical moment. And also current mayor Gong Zhen, and also another person, a leader, Shanghai leader, now moved to Gansu, Ying Hong, and also the Tianjin mayor, who previously also served as deputy party secretary of Shanghai, Liao Guoxun. These are all Shanghai background leaders, and I think that they are all in a very, very good position. Now, so you can see that Xi Jinping really trusts, relying on Shanghai leader, but also at the same time, you can also say that he certainly undermines some of the Shanghai gang members, you know, that the recent arrest related with the former vice mayor of Shanghai and also vice mayor of Shanghai, Gong Daoan, and also the former vice minister of public security, Sun Lijun, who also served as a Shanghai vice mayor before. So that's a very, very interesting development. All these trends show the dynamics and the complexities of China's factional politics at this pivotal moment in China's rise, with the U.S.-China relationship also, you know, leading towards a great confrontation and hostility. I think for U.S. grasping the internal dynamics of Chinese communist leadership is more critical than ever. We could not afford getting things wrong, but unfortunately, there are a lot of rumors, fake news, and wishful thinking, not careful understanding, analysis about Shanghai leader. I hope that the people will pay more attention to the importance of Shanghai and the fact that Xi Jinping relies on many cosmopolitan Shanghai leaders. And that's a very, very important observation, I think, for Western world.
Thank you so much, Cheng. And now I want to shift onto sort of broader macro territory here, which is, in your book, you study the attitudes and effects of returnees, the so-called haigui, those who went to the United States for university and then returned. And indeed, even Wang Huoning, despite not studying or being a student in America, he himself was a visiting scholar in America, where he wrote "美国反对美国," which is America against America. So I guess the question I want to ask is, what do you learn and what are the major findings you sort of could, I guess, summarize based on your book? And would you say that these findings are changing given recent circumstances and restrictions on travel and all the miscellaneous transformations to bilateral relations between Washington and Beijing?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned about Wang Huoning. I actually, when he came to US 1988 and to study, and the first stop was UC Berkeley, he worked under with my mentor, Barbara Scalpino. And when he came, he also came with the his teacher at Fudan, Ni Zixiong. And so we share the same similar mentors and in study of in his study in the U.S. that he later on also served as visiting scholar at the University of Michigan and also University of Iowa. And that book he published, he wrote that period in 1988, published it in 1991. 3 years later, it's really quite insightful. You know, you're looking back 30 years, there's so much insight. Now, of course, that my book is not about Wang Huoning, and I just mentioned him in passing. You know, when I returned to Shanghai as a visiting scholar at Fudan, he was the dean of that law school at Fudan, and but also department chair of international relations when I served as a visiting scholar, although my contact with him was very, very limited. Now, but the three chapters of my book really focus on the role of returnees. When people like Wang Huoning, when people like Liu He reach that high level and their entire career is spent on the government think tank, you can see that it's a very, very important development. It's a new path for the career elite recruitment. Unlike the previously always find the local government, neither Wang Huoning nor Liu He ever served as the local government, whether it be county, municipal, or province. Now, but of course, in my book, the three chapters on returnees talk about the broader impact. The depths and the breadths of the educational exchanges between these two countries with vastly different political system and ideologies throughout the past four decades have been truly remarkable. The sheer number of the Chinese nationals who study abroad and the tidal wave of the Chinese students and scholars who returned home after completing their overseas education was perhaps beyond anyone's imagination in 1978 when Deng Xiaoping and the President Jimmy Carter launched this educational exchange program. Now, between 1978 to 2019, about 6 million PRC citizens studied abroad, with significant percentage going to the United States. In 2018 alone, over 700,000 Chinese students studied overseas, making China the primary source of international students in other countries. As a result, China was the country that sent the most students to study overseas for 10 consecutive years. In the United States, 360,000 PRC students enrolled in schools that academic year in 2017 to 2018, the academic year, marking the ninth consecutive year that China sent the most foreign students to study in American schools. PRC students account for 33% of the total number of international students in the United States that year. The second country is India, account for 18% of the total number of international students in the US. You see the difference. Now, also significant of them return to China. Here, I just want to say, give you an example that how powerful that how influential these returnees serve in all walks of life in China, including in educational institutions, research centers, central and local governments, as I mentioned about the central government leaders, but also Shanghai municipal leaders, state and private enterprises, foreign and joint venture companies, law firms, hospitals, clinics, the media networks, and NGOs, name it. Now, in terms of the law, I just want to give an example because my book spent a lot of time talking about the influence of the lawyers with foreign trainings. Now, in the Zhongren law firm in Shanghai, one of the top law firms in the country, 75 out of the 112 partners in that law firm are foreign educated returnees, accounting for 2/3 of the total. A majority of these returning lawyer or law partners, actually 64%, receive their JD degrees in top law schools in the United States, including Harvard, Columbia, NYU, Stanford, Chicago, and UC Berkeley. And most of them have passed the bar exam in New York. Some also passed bar exam in California so that they can practice as a licensed attorneys in the key states for international finance and trade. With an increasingly global economy, globalized economy, and with the United States and other Western countries pressing China to meet international norm and the standards, especially in regarding enforcement and compliance with the intellectual property rights. These US educated Chinese lawyers may be instrumental in promoting cooperation and understanding across the Pacific in the years to come. So I think that, let me also mention, but the pervasive view about bilateral educational and cultural exchanges in Washington is no longer nowadays, it's no longer one of the hope for positive change through engagement, but rather one of the fear that the scholars and the students from the PRC attending American educational and research institutions are weapons, quote unquote weapons, of Chinese Communist Party, who will speed up China's ascent to superpower status in science technology at the expense of the United States. I think it's a very, very narrow-minded interpretation. So those educated elites not only contribute when they return to China, but those who remain in the U.S. also contribute to academic life and various walks of life in U.S., not least to help understand changing China. Now, one chapter of my book actually has J. William Fulbright's words as an epigraph. I quote here, "We must try to expand the boundaries of human wisdom, empathy, and the perception. And there's no way of doing that except through education." Now, my book raises the question, After all, if education cannot bridge minds across the Pacific, what can? Over.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
So you mentioned that you have three chapters on
education,
on Shanghai's on the returnee population, and one of those chapters is on avant-garde artists. And I guess I want to quickly ask, you know, why focus on that particular group of people, and what does avant-garde art tell us about Shanghai and the value of engagement?
Well, avant-garde art, there's two art chapters in my book. And these are not part of the three educational books. The educational exchange book, that's the three, including one is a survey research based on Horizon's multiple-year survey research. The two separate chapters on avant-garde. And avant-garde art, by definition, is ahead of time. They are really quite revealing. And some of the criticism of the United States, you early on mentioned about Wang Funing talk about the America against America. That was probably three decades ago. I mean, avant-garde art, I usually look at it almost 15, 20 years ago, but it continued until now. So it's quite remarkable, fascinating to see their discourse. They are not a fan of authoritarianism. They certainly promote some of the ideas like climate change, equality, social justice, women's rights, civil rights, and et cetera. But they are also quite critical about American arrogance, hegemonic thinking, and et cetera. Now, I also want to mention that I read somewhere a few years ago that 70 out of the best paid avant-garde artists in the world actually had a Chinese name. I mean, this is a fascinating finding. Many of them grew up during the Cultural Revolution. I think these dramatic changes in China made them more sophisticated, more critical in their artwork. Now, many of them live and work in Shanghai. Then some of them had opportunity to study in the United States, including Chen Yifei, later Chen Yifei, and Chen Danqing, and Gu Wenda. And also one person is not from Shanghai, Xu Bing, a friend of mine, he actually is having an exhibition right now in Shanghai. He is largely based in Beijing, but spent many years in the United States and also got the Genius Award from MacArthur Foundation. Now, over the past decade, China has hosted an average of 300 international exhibitions every year, a significant portion of which are focused on art and culture. Now, in recent years, Shanghai has experienced an exponentially rapid expansion of art galleries. According to a ranking by the World Cities Culture Forum based in UK, by 2019, Shanghai was ranked third in the world in terms of total number of art galleries, which is 770, behind only New York. It's like 1,500. And Paris, like 1,100. But Shanghai is ahead of the Tokyo, London, Rome, Brussels, and Los Angeles. So it's really quite remarkable. It's a short period of time Shanghai is catching up. Now, also, I spent a lot of time, actually almost one chapter describing the art gallery, the themes. And the Shanghai municipal government has actually recognized the need to establish excellent museums as the city's landmark, especially designating the 8-mile stretch of land on the newly developed western bound called Xi'an of the Huangpu River as the art district. The 4-mile-long Longteng Avenue along the western bound has already become home to dozens of museums and art galleries. Half of them are privately owned. Some of them are really gigantic. And when the whole project is completed, the West Bronx will be Asia's largest art corridor. Now, the art gallery boom in Shanghai reflects the evolving cultural dynamics. Middle-class residents in this cosmopolitan city have become increasingly dissatisfied with homogenized products and services, and are now demanding subculture identity, individuality, and diversity. Let me very quickly mention that, of course, there are some challenges in terms of political and media control and or censorship in Shanghai as elsewhere in the country. But we should not forget these dynamic scenes and also the soft power reflect the Chinese societal development. China's influence in this area, in art, architecture, music, films, television, I mean, particularly in East and Southeast Asia, is phenomenal. Now, let me also mention that two favorite woman anchor, TV anchor person, one is Dong Qing. He actually come from the same university I graduated from, Huadong Sida, East China Normal University. She is an anchor of many programs, including the most popular called the Reader, Yue Du Zhe. And another person is Jing Xing, is trans, gender person. And she was a dancer, now later become a late night show host. Most popular one, for many years. She's now the manager of the parliament, the traditional nightclub in Shanghai. This is tell you the dynamics of Shanghai. So I think the Western views about the monolithic thinking of China, of Shanghai, and even talk about societal threat, this is just completely wrong.
So I just want to ask, I guess, a slightly different question concerning education, just picking up on a strand that Nicholas raised just then. It seems to be harder for academic students, journalists, business people, and others to travel back and forth between the US and China, whether because of short-term factors like the quarantine or because of other structural, more long-term reasons, such as concerns over the tightening space with respect to discourses and speech in the country. Chang, how do you see this decline in affecting US and China relations? And what's the way out or remedy to this problematic situation?
Well, it's a serious problem. COVID-19 is decoupling itself in terms of international travel restrictions. Certainly, some of the things we're doing, like the online virtual webinar, like such as this, and also forms of communication like Douyin, like WeChat may help, but still different. We need to have a person-to-person contact. We need to close intimate, in kind of dialogue, a discourse. And the virtual things is still not reached that level. As we all know, that U.S.-China relation have deteriorated over the past 2 or 3 years at a speed and a scope beyond what could have been predicted. Blame games, propaganda wars, and the conspiracy theories have arisen from both sides of the Pacific. Not only has each side accused the other of being a genocide regime and speculated that the COVID-19 pandemic originated from a lab leak in the other country, but the risk of military confrontation and war between two superpowers is also on the rise, especially given the possibility of incidents, intended or unintended in the Taiwan Strait. But I also should mention the long-term implication of this pandemic of the century are far from clear. Even prior to the outbreak of the COVID-19, economic disparities within and between countries have already given rise to anti-globalization movements across the world. One can reasonably expect that the cynicism regarding regional and global integration, as well as the racial radical populism, racism, and xenophobia will likely all rise across many parts of the world, leading to a transformation of people's mindsets, behaviors, preference, and priorities. I mean, when two countries on the course for a major conflict, demonization, each other, is a common practice. So we should really stop that. We should, like the President Biden and President Xi Jinping recently said, America or China are both great countries. They're great peoples. But people now tend to forget that. And also, U.S.-China relations is not just a state-to-state relation, but should be also people-to-people relations. Now, one thing is related to your question is I think that China, in the recent maybe 5 to 10 years, heavily depend on domestic tourists at the expense of international tourists. That's a major problem, I would say. Now, there's one recent study by, I think, by United Nations and some of the also international organizations find that China's only have the China's foreign tourists only account for 0.3% of GDP. But that's very, very low. The international, the number is 3%. So the countries lower than China, let me mention some of them, Algeria and Venezuela, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Bangladesh, Congo, and Kuwait. So I think that's this is a serious problem. Now, Thailand is 12%. Again, China is 0.3%. So I hope that after COVID, Chinese government need to pay more attention and to promote international tourists and from all parts of the world. When you visit China, you contact with people, you will find we are all similar in many ways. And certainly that the middle class people, usually tourists are middle class people from other countries, can find the same aspiration and then develop respect and understanding. So I think their question embodies that things. But unfortunately, COVID is this moment, so to prevent that. So I think hopefully, you know, after COVID is controlled, China will really open up. And even during the current situation, I think China also needs to do some policy adjustment and because the cost is so overwhelming. I mean, I understand the Chinese position, and but I think it's a more thoughtful, balanced, forward-looking approach will be very, very helpful. Over.
Thank you, Cheng. And much of your analysis in the book, it precisely revolves or hinges upon that commonality, right? That sense of sentiment of similarities and converging attitudes between folks in Shanghai and also the counterparts in middle-class America, for instance. But I guess this leads us on to a methodological question I want to put to you, which is, now, there are two views as to this, right? One view is that Shanghai has a model. It's a Shanghai Mo Shi. So there's a model that can be transplanted and applied to other sort of similar cities in the mainland eventually, maybe Nanjing, maybe Guangzhou, maybe Shenzhen, etc., with variations and different degrees or some sort of transformations, nevertheless adapting to local circumstances. But underpinning that thought is that Shanghai can and should be transplanted elsewhere, ultimately. Another thought or another view, though, is that Shanghai is unique. It is a Shanghai particularist view that there's only one Shanghai in mainland China or in China at large, and there's only room, therefore, for one city of such a construct and configurations. I was wondering if we could pick your brain. Do you think Shanghai is exceptional in the second sense, such that there wouldn't be any transplantability or transferability? Or do you actually see your analysis of Shanghai being exceptional as precipitating the first sense where ultimately Beijing, Zhongnanhai, is seeking to transplant the Shanghai model and move it and shift it to other contexts as well within the country at large?
Well, this is a complicated question. My book really entirely tried to address that issue. I think it's both. On one hand, Shanghai is unique. It's China's most westernized country. Ironically, it's also the birth city of the Chinese communism, and also was a radical city during the Cultural Revolution. And as earlier I mentioned, it's the tale of two cities because it's a yes, you can see the power of state-owned enterprises, industrial policy, and you can even say state capitalism. But at the same time, Shanghai is it's market-driven and very open-minded, not only just in economic things, and a lot of experiments, the first stock market and the land leasing, to a certain extent, large-scale commercial land leasing, all started from Shanghai, and the Pudong development really profoundly changed China over the past two two or three decades. So it's a combination of that. Now, but I want to emphasize that we need to look at Shanghai, because Shanghai is a combination of three subcultures. One is local, the other is national, the third is post-cosmopolitan. This is not either or. They can combine together, form the unique cultural identity and Haipai culture, which is profoundly important. So again, this is echo to the theme of the book. We should not look at Shanghai or China in a monolithic term. This is not the cultural convergence, but the cultural communication, cultural exchanges, right? I mean, culture, I mean, when we talk about globalization, we refer to economic globalization. We do not refer to cultural globalization, because cultural globalization is itself a contradiction, because there's culture is always unique, always it's distinct from other, but does not mean you should be isolated, insulated. And also, no matter how much you change, Shanghai still maintains some of its characteristics before. But also I want to mention, Shanghai is always China's Shanghai. Even under the colonialism or semi-colonialism, and the local and the national culture play an important role. So I think this is a combination. Now, but the important thing is this is not, in a way, the broad term, it's not unique, just like New York, just like Paris, and et cetera. They also have these kind of functions. Now, what I said early on, the middle class and also foreign educated retainees sending students abroad, all Shanghai, like very much like a cradle, or one of the cradles in China, but then over they spill over to other region and the entire country. So in that regard, it's also part of the whole story, but it will never be the same. There's the country is so large. But the important thing is at the moment, the middle class is not just limited in coastal region, they expand. That's actually very good. But another thing is very, very important. When we talk about U.S.-China relation, we always look at the national level. So there's someone said that it's often said that the Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill disagree on everything except China, with certain truism, as I live in Washington. But at the local level, local meaning state or municipal level, it is a different kind of bipartisanship consensus regarding China, because local governments, with the legislature and the executive branch, I mean, local government, the governors and mayors, they want to engage with China. I mean, they established a sister city, sister state for the past two or three decades, whether it be educational and particularly economic exchanges are always very, very important. Now, according to one U.S. study released a few months ago, China is the largest import partner of 15 U.S. states in 2020, last year, including California, New York, Florida, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. These are very important states demographically and politically. I think when we talk about the Americans' current, very, very poor image of China and also bipartisanship, wanted to have tough on China, even, treat China as enemy. But we should be careful. Local level, it's a little bit different. Yes, there's some criticism of China for understandable reason, but also the tremendous need for cooperation, for engagement. I hope that my story of Shanghai, in that regard, will resonate well with many people live in the U.S. cities. They know that they are part of our United States, but also they are unique in its own way. So in that regard, Shanghai probably it's not that exceptional. Over.
So I have one more question, which is and it's kind of to take the central conceit of your book and think about applying it to different countries. What do you gain from looking at a country, whether it's their domestic situation or their standing in the world, through the prism of a single city? And do you think someone might learn something by looking at America's international presence through just the city of New York, or India's international presence by looking at just the city of Mumbai? Do you think there's value in looking at a country through the prism of one of its commercial capitals?
Well, I do believe that the few things. One is we should avoid monolithic thinking of a country, even a city. As I said, Shanghai is a tale of two cities or multiple dimensions. The others, we do need to pay attention to regional differentiations. And the sad truth, we sounds like we study China only focus on Beijing, maybe Xinjiang, but forget China is a vast different country. There's different regions, different perspective. There's also domestic competition, and you can see that during the Cultural Revolution, Shanghai subculture is largely suppressed. People only talk about national culture. And for a long time, for three or four, two decades or even longer, Shanghai actually declined. And when James Fellow, a distinguished American journalist, visited Shanghai, he wrote a piece, I think in early 1980, talking about Shanghai surprise. What surprised him is not about the changes, but rather no change, you know, during the Cultural Revolution and the previous three decades. So that tells you a story, a country, a city story could be profoundly important for a country's trajectory. And also that early on mentioned about the subnational interest and the pluralistic nature of, you know, our society. These are all relevant things I think we should keep in mind. If we consider Shanghai and pay more attention to Shanghai rather than purely Beijing, we may have different conclusion. And so I share the things with many American you know, journalists who report Shanghai and also many diplomats who stationed in Shanghai. They all tell me Shanghai, in that regard, it's just a fascinating story, different from Beijing. Now, a Chinese scholar, his name is Yang Dongping, he wrote a book called City of Monsoon. So all the related what wind, which direction the wind will go. So that tell you the importance to study of a city, to study about Haipai culture, and to understand China is not just a Beijing, but also a lot of different important cities, different subcultures, and also dynamics is always there. Over.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Cheng Li, author of Middle Class Shanghai, Reshaping U.S.-China Engagement. Cheng, I actually have a couple more final questions, which are, where can people find your work, and what's next for you?
Well, you can find my work from Brookings website and brookings.edu, but I think Hong Kong is okay, but China probably you have difficulties because of censorship. But my work is widely translated into Chinese. They are available and into a lot of interviews. I had numerous interviews just last year and published many articles. And also that, like Brian Wang, I published in China US Focus a lot, South China Morning Post a lot, and Foreign Affairs a lot. And my next book, I'm working on a new book called Xi Jinping's Protege, Rising Elite Group. You know, this is largely about the many new groups that start to emerge. I already mentioned about a think tank, but also from aerospace industry, just like Ma Xinri, you know, who just appointed as a party chief for Xinjiang, who previously is governor of Guangdong. He advanced his career largely from aerospace industry. There are many people similar to him, including Zhejiang Party Secretary Yuan Jiajun and many others. So these are the people that I think that we do need to know better and more objectively about these leaders will shape China, and they certainly are the important you know, leaders along with, you know, in the Xi Jinping, the third term. So this is the next book I'm currently writing about.
Well, I look forward to learning more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. Brian, where can people find you?
Thank you, Nicholas. Well, you can find me on Twitter at handle at Brian Wong OPR, or alternatively on Facebook, where I run a bilingual Facebook page, Brian Wong Huang Yu Shun.
Well, great. If I may, I want to add one thing. It's about my middle class Shanghai book, and it's available by Amazon.com, and also there's a Kindle copy as well. Now, the book is really 10 years work. It's talk about art, architecture, education, politics, and many other related subjects. So I think that, again, I'm from Shanghai, and with kind of a Shanghai entrepreneurship. But actually, all the loyalties go to Brookings and not go to me. But I think it's worthwhile to look at that book. And thank you so much for your interview.
We hope you subscribe to listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends who want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Sumantra Bose, author of Kashmir at the Crossroads, Inside a 21st Century Conflict. But before then, thank you so much, Chung, for joining me and Brian today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.